Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest poll from CNN that has Donald Trump ahead of Hillary Clinton, 45% to 43% among likely voters, with the race also tightening among registered voters, where Clinton is 3 points ahead. Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, joins us to discuss why, with 2 months to go until the election, Trump is gaining while Hillary Clinton is losing the double-digit lead she had after the Democratic convention, with the Trump campaign exhibiting a sudden professionalism since the disgraced former head of Fox News became its éminence grise. We will examine whether Clinton will go beyond making her campaign about Trump and how she can overcome the double standard of her being constantly tied to scandal while Trump gets away with endless outrages, having once remarked, perhaps prophetically, that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Then we will speak with a Filipino-born expert on the country whose foul-mouthed leader insulted President Obama ahead of a planned meeting at the ASEAN summit in Laos, which resulted in Obama cancelling the meeting and instead sitting down with the leader of South Korea. Joy Barrios-LeBlanc, a professor of Asian American and Asian Diaspora Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss how the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is seen at home and in the diaspora, and the role of nationalism in addressing fears of a more assertive China, at the same time being wary of reviving a neocolonial dependency on the United States. Then finally, we'll look into days and announcement by ITT Tech that it is shutting down its for-profit college racket that took in over $1 billion a year of taxpayer money. But now that the government has shut down the gravy train, this manifestly fraudulent institution has suddenly lost 90% of its funding and will no longer be able to defraud students with worthless diplomas while saddling them with a lifetime of debt. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Good Riddance, Six Facts About the ITT Tech Shutdown, and how long it will be before the biggest ripoff of them all, the University of Phoenix, has its taxpayer funding cut off and has to shut down. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for the New York Magazine and the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum. He's a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute and was formerly the vice president for policy and at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. His latest article at New York Magazine is "This Weird Election is Scrambling Some Reliably Red and Blue States." Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Ed. And what did you make of the CNN poll, which certainly has a lot of people alarmed?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of interesting. Every time people think this race has sort of settled down into a steady Hillary Clinton lead, you know, a couple of weeks ago it was high single digits. Last week it was low single digits. Then something comes out that upsets that assumption, and frankly, liberals sort of panic because they think she ought to be up 20, 30 points. The problem is, best I can tell from all the evidence, there's remarkably little movement of Republicans or Democrats in a crossover direction, and most of the flux has to do with independents, and there are a whole lot of there's a whole lot of uncertainty as to how many of them are actually going to show up and vote. And in fact, to me, perhaps the most surprising thing about the CNN poll was that Donald Trump was benefiting from a likely voter screen, as Republicans have in the past, but there'd been a lot of speculation that he would not benefit because he's targeting disproportionately marginal voters with lower educational levels. So it'll be interesting to see if that continues and as other polls switch over from registered to likely voters.
But when you say a lot of liberals think that Hillary Clinton should be 20 or 30 points ahead, I think that, you know, a lot of, you know, independents, a lot of, you know, analysts, nonpartisan analysts, even Republicans, I think, are probably wondering how could somebody that is such an appalling candidate, a person that is shocking in so many ways, and everybody is piled on, starting with the former, the last Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, who really did slam Donald Trump as a complete fraud. I mean, and yet somehow or other, he's, if he's not level with her, he's certainly close to her. And frankly, I find it mystifying.
Well, I don't. I've been saying for a good while now that Adolf Hitler himself would probably get 40% of the vote on a major party ticket. This is where we are. There's been so much attention paid to elite Republican defections that a lot of people haven't noticed that the rank and file are not moving at all, really, in most polls. And, you know, that's polarization. You can say that Mitt Romney has said terrible things about, or implied terrible things about Mitt Romney, and other conservatives have too, but remember that conservative voters have heard nearly a quarter of a century of venom about Hillary Clinton. So aside from their partisan voting habits, it would be really difficult in a relatively brief period of time to overcome that disadvantage for Clinton in reaching out to Republicans. And I think that's pretty much the story here.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. And he was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. And his latest article at New York Magazine is "This Weird Election is Scrambling Some Reliably Red and Blue States." Now, it looks as though Trump is starting to scramble some of the states. I take it he's starting to improve in Michigan and Wisconsin, which are very key, and also in Florida. Do you see this a possibility that the eminence gris, the gray eminence behind the scenes, Roger Ailes, has suddenly brought a professionalism to Trump's campaign? At least somebody has, surely.
Well, I don't really know how much emphasis I would place on that. It certainly doesn't hurt. To me, the bigger reality is that Trump has gambled this entire election on achieving an unusually high percentage of and mobilizing one demographic of voters, white working class voters. The states where Trump appears to be doing better than Mitt Romney did are mostly those with relatively large white working class populations and relatively few minority voters. Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania are great examples. And then there are a couple of other states in the South, Florida and North Carolina, that don't quite fit that mold, but that the race is close enough that Trump could, you know, if he improves a little bit nationally, win. So it's a very narrow path to 260 electoral votes because it involves conceding an awful lot of other battleground states that certainly Mitt Romney tried to win in the past. But, you know, if he manages to put together all of those states, he's got a chance.
Well, does this mean, though, that Hillary Clinton could win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote?
That's a little bit unlikely because she's probably going to pile up a lot of popular votes, or, you know, in the technical terminology, waste a lot of votes in certain states that are going to be big, big Democratic margins, including California, New York, Illinois, and then, you know, win a lot of Latino votes in states that are probably going to go Republican, like Texas. So probably not. But the reality is this: Hillary Clinton has a has multiple paths to 270 electoral votes, Trump has basically won. I'd much rather be in her position than his, and that's totally aside from the fact that she has the money and the expertise to do some get-out-the-vote strategies in close states, and Trump really doesn't.
Well, does this mean, though, because Hillary Clinton is unpopular, as this recent Washington Post ABC News poll indicated, record unpopularity, and the only person worse off than her is Donald Trump. So that would suggest that even though there's apparent enthusiasm amongst certain Republican voters for Trump, I don't detect a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. So could this mean a low turnout of election and therefore the Democrats won't take the Senate?
Well, that's a completely separate question about the Senate, and you really have to look state by state. But no, I mean, I think, and I've written about this, I think that hatred and fear of the opposition are taking the place of enthusiasm as a get-out-the-vote motivator this year, and I think it'll be pretty effective. All the polls are indicating that an unusually high percentage of voters view this as a high-stakes election. It really does matter who wins. That's what differentiates this from some other close, vicious races like 2000 and 2004. As far as enthusiasm goes, I mean, I've got an old line I use about that, you know, any enthusiasm beyond which is necessary to get you to the polls to vote is a waste. It doesn't really matter whether you're excited or enthusiastic or snake dancing to the polls as long as you vote. So I'm not that worried about the lack of enthusiasm behind Hillary Clinton. And I don't think there's any doubt that the atmosphere, the competitive atmosphere, and certainly the hatred and fear towards Donald Trump is going to be a potent factor going down the stretch. And I think Clinton's team is going to do everything they can to promote that.
And since Trump pulled off quite a surprise with his trip to Mexico, which certainly did him some good, could he pull off another stunt like go to the Middle East? Or the other thing that might help him in terms of what's often referred to as October surprises is that the Italians are voting on their Brexit vote in October. And the Nobel laureate economist Joe Stiglitz is afraid that the Italians may well follow Britain, the British voters, in voting out of the euro, which would crash the euro and cause a lot of uncertainty in the global markets, which would affect the U.S. economy.
Well, that's a very indirect kind of Rube Goldberg process. I guess it's possible. But unless it really begins to affect tangible economic indicators that Americans understand, it probably won't matter. The usual rule of thumb is that, you know, barring the kind of catastrophe we had in 2008, economic trends after about the middle of an election year don't usually make any difference whatsoever. Now, as far as, you know, stunts, Donald Trump can get some positive attention for an overseas trip or something like that, but the effect of that sort of gimmick usually fades after a few days, so it would have to be very, very late. If I were in Hillary Clinton's camp, I'd be a little more concerned about the debates, which are highly observed events. There are going to be three of them plus a vice presidential event, and there's actually a forum, which means consecutive, not simultaneous appearances by the candidates, on Wednesday night. I do believe they're very focused on that, but those are the kind of events more likely to change minds.
Well, by nature, of course, a debate puts Donald Trump on as an equal on the stage. But
right.
What about turning the other side, which is what can Hillary Clinton do to regain her lead? Would for example, I'm astounded that and particularly this refers to the down ballot on the Democratic side. I'm astounded why they haven't been able to make more of this outrage over Zika, where the Republicans are literally placing the health of American women and their unborn children at risk to protect the Confederate flag, et cetera. And I'm also astounded why Hillary Clinton can't make more of the apparently real interference on the part of Putin and Russia in destabilizing the elections, if not trying to throw them for Trump.
Well, taking the second point first, I wouldn't be surprised if she, I mean, she's had a couple of references to Putin recently. I wouldn't assume that she's not going to make some hay over that possibility down the stretch. It's certainly not too late for that, or at least to warn of possible interference with the election, not just by Russia, but by independent hackers. However, when it comes to attacking Republicans in Congress, I'm afraid that Clinton is sort of on the horns of a dilemma. She has chosen to make a big deal out of Donald Trump's estrangement from Republican leaders and Republican principles. It's a little hard to do that and then turn around and try to blame Trump or identify Trump with Republican obstruction in Congress. So, I think she's kind of chosen her approach on that one in a way that may foreclose some other opportunities. I don't know. I've been somewhat critical of that decision, by the way, but that's where she is.
Well, then, just in closing, Ed Kilgore, if we know, for example, if you ask somebody, what does Donald Trump stand for? They immediately say he's going to make America great again and build a wall. If you ask the same question, what does Hillary Clinton stand for? Quite often you get a deafening silence. I mean, she's got all kinds of wonks there on her staff coming up with policy papers. Her website is full of policy positions, really deeply fleshed out. But in the simplistic way that often people think in terms of campaign slogans, stronger together doesn't cut it. Do you think there's a basic deficiency in basically her simple branding?
Well, I'd go back to what I said earlier. Hillary Clinton, in some respects, is not a politician. She's a pop culture figure, who has been defined over an incredibly long period of time by friends and by enemies. I mean, an awful lot of Democrats are voting for her without paying any attention to her policy positions. It's because, A, she's a Democrat, and, B, she'll be the first woman to become president. So I think she's really got a struggle in becoming anything, in becoming a more defined figure in the way that Donald Trump has been defined by a couple of big-picture topics. However, I do think that down the stretch you'll see in her paid advertising emphasis on policy positions that poll extremely well, such as minimum wage increases, equal pay, pre-kindergarten education, paid family leave, that sort of thing. I think you'll hear more of that. And certainly she has an opportunity in the debates to emphasize a few positions.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Ed Kilgore.
Anytime, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly the vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. His latest article at New York Magazine is "This Weird Election is Scrambling Some Reliably Red and Blue States." We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the remarks by the foul-mouthed leader of the Philippines, who managed to have Obama cancel a meeting on him.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride.
and I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joy Barrios-LeBlanc, who is a professor of Asian American and Asian Diaspora Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, who received her doctorate in Filipino and Philippine Literature at the University of the Philippines and has served as a professor and associate dean of the University of the Philippines College of Arts and Letters. She is the author and editor of more than a dozen books, among them To Be a Woman is to Live at a Time of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joy Barrios-LeBlanc.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm actually a lecturer with the South and Southeast Asian Studies. I teach for both departments.
Okay, lecture with the Berkeley...
South and Southeast Asian Studies.
Okay. So, having belatedly corrected that, Joy, I'm sorry about that. Let's talk about the foul-mouthed leader of the Philippines who's been conducting this war on drugs. It's actually quite lethal. I think over 2,000 people have been murdered without trial, extrajudicial killings, which I think there was an expectation that President Obama was going to talk about it. The UN have condemned it. Many world leaders have condemned President Duterte. So when he was asked recently whether he would talk to Obama about this or Obama would bring it up, he said something to the effect that the son of the whore better not bring it up. And thus we have the flap, which then resulted in the president canceling a meeting with him on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit in Laos. And now, of course, the president instead is meeting with the president of South Korea. So just in the overall broad scheme of things, Joy, it would seem that the president of the Philippines shot himself in the foot.
Well, I think that we have to put things in context. First of all, I don't really think that he was cursing at the president of the United States. It was a curse, but several people have argued that what exasperated him was the question of the reporter and that the reporter had kind of like said, oh, you are the president of the United States will ask you to explain why you did this and blah, blah, blah. And we all know that very touchy when it comes to this war against drugs, because while it is true that there are extrajudicial killings, and while it is true that it is many, there like 1,000 people have been killed, it's also true that one or two police officers are being killed every day, and that the issue is much more complex than what it actually is. And so this is not to excuse the, let me say, foul language. But we need to understand that for many of us Filipinos, what we heard in that long speech was less than one statement, but more of the rest of the speech when he was trying to explain that I will not explain myself to anyone. I don't owe any world leader an explanation. I will not bow down to the United States. So you begin to ask, why? And of course, there are two things that we need to mention here. First, that there is a complex relationship between the Philippines and the United States, that the United States had colonized the Philippines and that more than 1.4 million Filipinos died in that whole process of colonization. And second, that the current visiting forces and now the EDCA agreement in the Philippines have resulted in a lot of tension. A few years back, Jennifer Lauder, a transsexual, was killed by a U.S. Marine. And so we need to contextualize these statements.
Well, I guess, Joy Barrios LeBlanc, that gets to the broader question then, which is that, you know, the role of nationalism in addressing fears of, one, a more assertive China on the one hand, which the previous president certainly was worried about, and he brought a suit to at the international court, which China just lost over its activities in the South China Sea. He also wanted to, as you just mentioned, bring back the defense arrangement with the United States or revive it. But at the same time, I take it that Filipinos are wary of reviving a neocolonial dependency on the United States. So is that the dilemma? On the one hand, fear of China. On the other hand, fear of the embrace of U.S. Bases.
Actually, I don't think there should be a dilemma at all. I believe that the Philippines should stand up to China as it has, and doing two things. Number one is bringing up the matter in an international court, and second, exploring the possibility of having bilateral talks. But not to budge on that issue. But second, also standing up to any other world power who would want, who would not respect the sovereignty of the Philippines. I understand and I agree that nations need to have allies, but I also think that I belong to an organization who stands firmly against the visiting forces and the EDCA agreement, in the same manner that I was there when the United, when the Philippine Senate had voted to remove the U.S. bases in the Philippines. I believe that for a nation to be truly sovereign, it should stand on its own 2 feet. And I am hoping that finally we have a president who will be very clear about that issue.
But in terms of defense, the Philippine Navy is almost, I think, doesn't have any ships at sea except for some small craft. And the Philippine Air Force doesn't have, I don't think it even has one serviceable jet plane that's flying.
I understand that. But you're looking at it from the framework of war. Yes, but we're looking at it from the point of view of negotiations and going the route of international courts. Because this has always been, in the past, kind of the message of fear. Okay, if you don't align yourself with the United States, or if you stand up against the United States, well, these other countries will bully you. But if you think about it, the nations who have invaded us were Spain, Japan, and the United States. China has never invaded us. It is true that we have this dispute at present, but I am confident that through bilateral talks, through peaceful negotiations, then we will perhaps, hopefully, reach an agreement. The president of the Philippines is a man of peace, and that's the reason that for the first time in decades, we have peace talks that might actually succeed. And in a country wherein there's been so much war, that matters to a lot of us.
But when you say China has not invaded the Philippines, which is obviously true, but Japan, the U.S. and Spain have, China nevertheless occupies Scarborough Shoals, which is about 100 miles west of the Philippines, very close to the Philippines, normally
always
considered part of their territory. China, on the other hand, is thousands of miles from the Scarborough Shoals. So how do you negotiate that one away? Is that underway?
Yeah, you're right about that. It's true, because historically, from their point of view, because there are two maps, right? You have their map and the other map. And so in their map, it's part of their territory. So they say, for centuries, this is ours. And of course, it's a matter of dispute. I cannot pretend to be a foreign policy expert. As my field is in arts and literature, but I do believe that instead of thinking in terms of war and giving the argument that we need the United States troops presence in the Philippines because we need to be prepared for war against China, we should move towards a direction when we should seek peace and talks with China. And I also believe that it's important for the Philippines. I was in a forum several years back at Harvard, and we were talking about all these other ASEAN nations actually claiming parts of the disputed territories. And I think what's also helpful for the Philippines would actually be to engage these other Southeast Asian countries in talks. And should there emerge in the region, perhaps a country that one could describe to be more assertive than other countries, then these other countries perceived to be less strong militarily could perhaps talk among each other and see how they can support each other.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Joy Barrios-Leblanc, when you say that President Duterte is a man of peace, how does that gel with his policy of extrajudicial killing, of encouraging vigilantes to murder drug dealers, whether or not they're actually drug dealers or not? And by the way, a number of innocent people have been shot, women and children have been shot as collateral damage, as they say.
Mm.
So, and go ahead. Yeah.
I do understand your concern in literature. He is what we would call perhaps an interrogative character. And more than 1 million Filipinos have suffered because of this drug problem. And I believe there are about 20,000 police officers implicated, mayors, governors. So it is a tough battle for any president. It is true that, one, you have to cope with what we call the vigilante groups. And these vigilante groups could be paid men by these drug lords. Second, you have to cope with police officers. While it is true that there are honest police officers who may have killed drug pushers because these drug pushers fought back, it is also true that many police officers kill the drug pushers because otherwise the drug pushers would tell on them that they were in on the take. So it's a vicious cycle. However, my group and I, we are against this extrajudicial killings. And I think that the president and the chief of police should do more to safeguard human rights. However, we also believe that we need to remember that during the term of President Benigno Aquino, farmers were massacred. The Lumad indigenous people were killed. And yet that government remained silent. During the government of President Arroyo, more than 1,000 activists were victims of extrajudicial killings. And so for the past decades, we have been fighting this as human rights activists. But there are several people who have suddenly become human rights activists because they don't like the new president. And yet in the past, they remained silent and watched as activists and farmers and indigenous people were killed.
Well, I think you've made your point very effectively, Joy, of a double standard there, particularly in the United States. It's always sort of praised Benigno Aquino, etc. So we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Joy Barrios-LeBlanc, who's a lecturer in South and Southeast Asian Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She received her doctorate in Filipino and Philippine Literature at the University of the Philippines and has served as a professor and associate dean of the University of Philippines College of Arts and Letters. And she's an author and editor of more than a dozen books, among them To Be a Woman is to Live at a Time of War. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into today's announcement by ITT Tech that it is shutting down its for-profit college racket. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He is previously a senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Bill Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Good Riddance, Six Facts About the IT&T Tech Shutdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian.
And we've spoken a lot over the years about this for-profit college racket, and finally the Department of Education is doing something. And it's pretty coincidental and fairly obvious that the minute that the Department of Education says we're not going to give you any more federal money, this IT&T tech goes out of business, which makes it clear, that they're not some private enterprise, free enterprise alternative to public education, but they are, in fact, completely welching off the taxpayer's dime.
That's right. As you know, many of these schools get nearly 90% of their revenue from federal student grants and loans. And in fact, there's a law that says they can't get more than 90% from the Department of Education. They can squeeze a little bit more out of the Pentagon and the VA for service members and vets. But last year it was Corinthian Colleges, and this year ITT. If you are entirely dependent on the feds, and the feds ultimately decide that you're behaving in predatory and crooked ways, it's a death sentence, and that's what's happened here with ITT.
But is there something coincidental about this, that Arne Duncan was the Secretary of Education, very close friend of President Obama's, and only recently he stepped down and elevated his deputy? And it seems like since then there's been a sea change in not just, you know, paying out, you know, taxpayer money to keep these crooks alive and keep them ripping off the taxpayer. You know, there's been a move to cut them off from the gravy train.
Well, I think that, yes, I'd like to give credit to Secretary King and Undersecretary Ted Mitchell, Rohit Chopra, who recently left the department to join the Clinton transition. There are people there that are concerned, but I think the previous folks were concerned too, but I think also the evidence has just mounted. There are more and more federal and state law enforcement investigations, which I've documented on a webpage on my website, Republic Report. And it's harder and harder for the department, which has been the most sort of old-fashioned and just listening to the schools and not wanting to cross the schools, but it's harder and harder for them to ignore the real-world evidence, both in these law enforcement investigations and media investigations, that are showing how crooked these schools are. But even with Corinthian shutdown and ITT shutdown, there are many large and small for-profit schools that are still engaging in predatory behavior. While you and I are doing this segment, more students are signing up, listening to deceptive and coercive pitches and signing up. So there's still a long way to go to get a handle on this problem.
Well, when you say that lawsuits, et cetera, were piling up and some press attention was given, I'm not sure about press attention, but certainly IT&T was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Attorney Generals of New Mexico, Arkansas, Arizona, Connecticut, Idaho, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, Nebraska, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Washington. And they got been getting as much as $1.1 billion annually from the taxpayer, and last year they got $664 million. I'd say the list of people that have been suing them should have gotten somebody's attention.
Yes, a long time ago. And frankly, students were complaining a long time ago. The reason I really got interested in this issue, I started to get involved in it about 6 years ago, was that I met a couple people from ITT Tech, a student who told me that the education was just a joke and that he was a Navy veteran, and his classes were using pirated software and outdated textbooks, and that he would write on his exams, "Is anyone reading this?" And nobody responded, clearly showing that it was just completely on autopilot there. And I met a financial aid instructor who told me she'd been fired because she reported that she was being asked to falsify financial aid forms. They were both from ITT Tech, and I really, you know, that's when I really realized that something very bad was going on here with our tax money in this sector, and it was ITT Tech that really opened my eyes to it.
Well, the reason why I think it's important, and we've revisited this story a lot, and finally there's some good news in as much as some of the more flagrant ripoffs are being shut down, although it's worth noting that the University of Phoenix, EDMC, Career Education Corporation, Kaplan, and Bridgepoint are still alive and well, and in fact, the advertisements on television by the University of Phoenix are so pernicious. I mean, they really do. They have astronauts. They have all kinds of successful people shilling for them.
They had Ellen DeGeneres this year.
Right.
She awarded a mom on Mother's Day. She gave her a gift of a scholarship, a college scholarship. It was to the University of Phoenix. That was no scholarship. It was more like a coupon. But when we complained, Ellen took down some of her social media. But, you know, when there's so much money involved, the University of Phoenix has gotten as much as $4 billion of our tax money in a single year. Now they're still getting $2 billion. You can buy people.
Well, I think that's why I see this for-profit education racket as a window into the broader racket that is Washington, D.C., or as a friend of mine described it, Nigeria on the Potomac, where you have basically the revolving door of former congresspeople like the Washington lobbyist Vin Weber, who was part of the GOP leadership. He's been on the board of IT&T
for 22 years.
You've got the idea that they have all kinds of prominent lobbyists from both sides of the aisle, and that they lobby the Congress, and they basically just raid the till, dress it up as free enterprise, an alternative to public education, etc., and they fly congressmen around in their private jets. I mean, I guess this is the most kind of obvious example of the pay-to-play culture in Washington.
This is one of the worst. It's one of the worst I've ever seen. They own all kinds of – this industry owns all kinds of people, whether they buy them as lobbyists, they buy them as politicians, they buy them as consultants. They know that since they're getting 90% of their money from taxpayers, that what they have to do to stay in business is to invest in Washington. Senator Dick Durbin said they own every lobbyist in town, which is pretty close to being true. And all kinds of people who are considered liberals and considered progressives have taken money from this industry and sold their credibility to it because it's hard to resist the lure of money. And it is exactly what's wrong with our system. And, you know, thank heavens now people like Senator Elizabeth Warren, Dick Durbin, Congressman Keith Ellison have stood up, and the people who defended the industry are still doing it behind the scenes on Capitol Hill, but they're less likely to do it publicly because finally I think the public has become aware of how toxic and how really disgusting this industry is and how it's behaved. But it doesn't mean that students don't still sign up, because there are all kinds of boiler room operations and bait and switch ways that they get low-income people on the phone, people desperate to change their lives, whether they're single moms or veterans, and they tell them lies about accreditation and about job placement and about financial aid and about the cost, and they'll call them 10 times a day until they sign up. And this is still going on. And everyone in this election ought to demand of their member of Congress and of their presidential candidates, you know, what are you doing about this? We know what Donald Trump was doing about it. He was running his own predatory, unaccredited, for-profit college, Trump University. And I recently discovered that two of their top executives were hiding out at a school in Florida, Ultimate Medical Academy, 90% of the students online, $150 million a year of your tax money going. So it's not just these big schools that I've been writing about. There's all kinds of small institutions that are engaging in this predatory behavior and continuing to take our tax money. And again, as you said, buying Washington in order to protect themselves and keep the scam going. Thank heavens the Department of Education is increasing accountability, not only through going after bad schools, but through new regulations that are making it harder to cheat.
Well, it's interesting that on that list of states' attorney generals that I read that have sued IT&T, that have just shut down because the Department of Education pulled the plug on the money train, Pam Bondi, the AG of Florida, was looking into Trump University, and Trump sent her a $25,000 check from his foundation, which is illegal, by the way.
Yeah.
And suddenly the investigation went away, and now she's one of his top campaign advisors. So
yes. But that's true, and she also made it went easy ultimately on Kaplan, which she was investigating. I don't know why. So yeah, it's an odd situation. Some of the AGs have been very strong on this, and some have wavered. And Pam Bondi was one who clearly wavered when it came to Donald Trump.
But when you say that these Congress people are both active and retired, get money from these big for-profit college rackets that depend 90% of their income comes from the taxpayer. Therefore, it is logical to assume that, in effect, the taxpayer is paying for these congresspeople. We're paying their
Yes. I mean, we're paying Trent Lott and John Breaux, former senators, to lobby on behalf of the for-profit college industry, which they did for many years. When they sue, when the industry sues to overturn the Obama administration's regulations to hold them accountable, we're paying for their lawyers. They have Gibson Dunn, one of the most expensive law firms in the country. We're paying for the government to defend against their lawyers, and we're paying for the judge and the courthouse and everything else. We're paying for almost the entire thing. And that's the nature of this industry. They get the money, and then they sue as if they're entitled to the money in perpetuity, no matter how much fraud they commit. It's again, one of the worst scandals I've ever seen. And if you want honest government, you need to ask your members of Congress, are you standing with these corrupt for-profit colleges, or are you standing with the veterans and hardworking people that are getting scammed by these colleges, and demand answers because these are exactly the kind of scams that we need to stop if we want to have honest, efficient government and any meaning to our democracy at all.
But you would think it would be against the law for congresspeople to take campaign money from the federal government itself. I mean, which is what they'd call a cutout. You know, where it goes from the taxpayer to these for-profit colleges, and then goes back to the Congress.
Well, there's a lot of industries like this. The oil and gas get subsidies from the taxpayers. Obviously, the defense industry is largely financed by taxpayers. All these people have lobbyists too.
Right.
I don't know how to stop that. In a sense, because you're entitled to, obviously, if you're a company or a person, you're entitled to petition your representatives. All I can do is come on your show and keep writing articles and everything else, and all you can do is to keep blowing these things up and make people feel outraged. But I don't think there's any way to stop this practice of publicly funded things also being able to lobby the government.
Well, but it's a sort of self-licking ice cream.
That's
the thing that's disgusting about it, and our tax money perpetuates the fraud. But the good news, of course, is that the Department of Education is now moving against these. Do you think they'll move against the University of Phoenix to the tune of what?
Well, look what happened there, Ian. That's another crazy thing that happened. The University of Phoenix, the biggest, you know, company engaged in lots of predatory behavior. Their online division has a 4% graduation rate for first-time full-time students. 96% of the students sign up, pay the money, and then never get their degree. Well, so what did they do this year? They decided the Apollo Education Group, which owns them, to be acquired by the Apollo private equity firm based in New York, and they frankly told Reuters that they chose a partner in Chicago to be their partner in this acquisition, Vistry, because it would help grease the political wheels in Washington. Who is Vistria? It is President Obama's best friend and the head of the Obama Foundation, Library Foundation, Marty Nesbitt, and the former Deputy Secretary of Education, who's his partner in that firm. The two of them went in and became partners in the University of Phoenix, and now they're asking the Department of Education to approve the transfer, a change of ownership, and continue to give them $2 billion a year. That's pretty cynical, and they got, you know, those guys were beat up, and this was an opportunity for Republicans to beat up on the Democrats in this context, because what were these guys doing? They actually were, you know, the Deputy Secretary of Education was involved in regulating this industry. Now he owns this industry, and now he's lobbying his former, I don't know, he's personally lobbying, but his presence is a signal to his former agency, you know, help us out here, do us a solid on this one. That's, you know, another example of just blatant corruption this industry partakes of.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, we started out the program today with Ed Kilgore, who does the Democratic strategist and writes on politics for New York Magazine.
Right.
And we were talking, I mean, basically I'm astounded that not only does the CNN poll out today give Donald Trump, put him ahead of Hillary Clinton in likely voters, I would say the fact that Hillary Clinton is not 20 points ahead in this race is mystifying. What the hell is going on here, David? I can't for the life of me don't understand why she's not 20 points ahead as opposed to 2 points behind in the CNN poll.
No, I mean, I find it absolutely stunning. Trump is a racist and emotionally just obviously very, very troubled. And knows nothing of policy, has a record of abusing and ripping off his, you know, business partners and associates and customers. So I don't get it, other than that people are just more entertained by Trump than they are by, you know, Hillary Clinton, not the most dynamic candidate for president. I think in the end she will win, but I don't think anyone should be complacent about it. I'm not a nonprofit organization, and so I can say, in my personal opinion, everybody should be out there doing everything they can. I'm going to go to a swing state at the end of this cycle and do everything I can, and I've pledged to do anything I can to help elect Hillary Clinton. I think she's also got it. You know, President Clinton has his issues with a for-profit college and that he worked for one, Laureate Education, but she has pledged to do something about this issue, and I believe her, and she's hiring people like Rohit Chopra who are committed to reforming it. But I think on that issue and a million others, Trump is a catastrophe. I can't explain, except that a lot of people are bigots, and a lot of people find him entertaining. But I would encourage everyone out there to do everything they can to make sure he does not become president. I will tell you right now that if he does become president, I've spent 25 years working on public policy. I won't do it anymore. I'm going to go find another career, because it's just absolute madness to would be to work in a public policy world defined by a childish, you know, racist lunatic as at the head of the federal government. I won't do it.
Well, but if she squeaks by Hillary Clinton, it would indicate probably that the turnout will be low. It's unlikely that the Senate will be captured by the Democrats, and we'll have gridlock. Even if she gets there, we'll have more gridlock. And frankly, the thing that bothers me is that I don't think, if you ask anybody, what does Donald Trump stand for? They'll say he's going to make America great again and build a wall. Yeah. You ask the same question, what does Hillary Clinton stand for? And you get a deadly silence.
Well, and that's really odd, because if you look at her website, she's got hundreds of pages of the, you know, wonkiest. I mean, yes, people don't get the big picture, but man, they're sitting there generating policy ideas all day long. I mean, I got a release the other day that was so incredibly specific on an issue. I was like, wow. So yeah, they're kind of missing the forest for the trees. In terms of communicating, for a while they had a slogan, and I read about it in the paper, and I wrote to the campaign. I said, "This is her slogan." I was not aware of that, and I do follow politics. I think "Stronger Together" is a decent slogan. It doesn't have a lot of meaning other than that Trump is a bigot, but I think that's not bad. But I mean, she's still got an opportunity to focus and say what are some things that she really wants to do, and really, you know, drill down on those. I haven't seen that yet. But I think that would be a good thing to do. And the biggest issue, I think, in my mind, and with the issue where she's clearly different from Trump, even though Trump seems to be attracting a lot of these voters, is that our middle class way of life is being destroyed. The rich are getting richer, and you know, people don't have pensions anymore. They don't have health insurance anymore through their jobs. They're living in their grandparents' basements and taking all their grandparents' savings away, because we just don't have those kind of lives anymore that people are being offered of a good job and a good future sort of guaranteed for you. Instead, you're an Uber driver. So if she could figure out a way to tell people that really, well, I think she does have plans to try to figure these things out, I think that could make a difference. The people are not inspired right now. People are going to need to turn out and vote if there's a chance of beating Trump, because I think his core voters are pretty excited to vote for the race.
Absolutely. Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and it's always great to be on your show.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern as a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Good Riddance, Six Facts About the ITT Tech Shutdown. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.